All right, so today we have a very special guest. Today we have Zumrad I. Arkin, the Program and Advocacy Manager for the World Uyghur Congress. Zumrad I., how are you doing today?
Hi, Jeremy. I'm good. What about you?
I'm doing well. Doing well. It's a little early here in New York, but...
yeah, thanks for having me this early.
Of course. So we're obviously, you know, right now in China, it's perhaps one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world today. And I don't think a lot of people know about it. So I wanted to have you on today to talk and kind of get the word out. But before we get into that, you have an interesting background. I know you're born in Xinjiang, East Turkestan. So if you would, could you explain a little bit about who you are and then after what you do for the World Uyghur Congress?
Yes, thank you. So yes, I was born and raised in East Turkestan in Urumqi, which is the capital of the region. And I grew up there until I was 10. And then I immigrated with my family to Canada at a very young age. So I do still have, you know, a lot of memories from back then. And I pretty much, I think for the first time I kind of realized about my own, you know, unique ethnic Uyghur identity was when I went back for the first time after immigrating to Canada in 2009. So it was during July 2009, during the Urumqi uprising. And I did witness the whole, you know, system of discrimination and how Uyghurs were treated as second-class citizens in our own homeland. So we were racially profiled at the airport, but also just, you know, very racist comments from people, or just the treatment that we received was just clearly discriminatory. So when we went back to Canada, I decided to be more involved in my own community and become more vocal about the issues. And I started learning more about the issue, and I realized that actually, you know, it was decades of discriminatory policies. And I was more in touch, I guess, with my own identity, but also with our own history, because this is not something that you get to discover back in China or in the region, because you're just brainwashed at a very young age and information is also censored. So slowly I became more involved within my own community. And then in university, I was more interested in like politics and international relations, which this is what I graduated in. And also I did go to law school, and I was more interested in the human rights aspect and also international law. And then I was offered a job in September 2019, and I moved to Munich, Germany. And I've been working ever since as a program advocacy manager here. And I mostly deal with UN advocacy. So really presenting the Uyghur issue at the UN in, you know, different UN mechanisms, meeting with different UN bodies and also experts and different country missions to really bring awareness to the situation and also pressure for change.
Great. So a lot of people in the West, they hear about, you know, there's obviously a great humanitarian issue in China, but they're not even sure who the Uyghurs are. Who are the Uyghurs? Where do they come from? What's their background?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And well, the Uyghur people are actually Turkic ethnic Muslim, you know, majority Muslim people in the region, which I think, you know, oftentimes we're portrayed as Chinese, but we're quite, our identity and culture is quite different from the, you know, the main Chinese culture. We are mostly Central Asians. We are more connected to the Central Asian, you know, different cultures, for example, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, Uzbeks, rather than the Chinese culture, because we're actually, historically, we're nomad people, and our cultures and the Turkic culture is very present. Our language is a Turkic language. Our script, for example, is Arabic script. So we're very much in, you know, we share, I would say, similar cultures within the Persian and also Central Asian parts of the world rather than the Chinese. We actually are, Muslim, like I said. So our country was actually occupied in 1949 by the Chinese Communist Party when the People's Liberation Army walks in the region to occupy and annex the land, which then in 1955, they called, recalled it the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. Xinjiang means a frontier, a new frontier. So it clearly, you know, tells you that there was a colonization process, just like they did with Tibet, just below our region, and also southern Mongolia. So I would say in general, yeah, in overall, the Uyghur people are ethnic, Central Asian ethnically distinct people from the Han Chinese people.
Right. So totally distinct people. Now, I want to fast forward to present day. You mentioned that you're occupied in 1949. Has there been constant discrimination since then?
Yes. So I think this is one aspect in which a lot of people, I think, confuse the situation, or there's a lot of misinformation saying that the crisis or the repression that Uyghurs faced started in 2017 with the camps. But it actually was over decades of repressive policies and discriminatory policies implemented by the Chinese government. And with colonization, of course, you have the natural, I would say, process of, you know, the call of colonization is, you know, settlers coming in the region and occupying the region and getting all the jobs and you know, the land and all that. So this process started in 1949. And with that, of course, the Chinese settlers came in the region and took the lands, took the jobs. And slowly, the migration process that started, that was heavily started in 1980s, made it that there was a bigger presence and a more important presence of Chinese, Han Chinese in the region, which, of course, the Uyghurs are still the majority in the region, which is why we actually don't like to use the term ethnic minority when you talk about Uyghurs, because we're not a minority in our own region. We're actually the majority. And over time, of course, the Han Chinese population has increased. If you look at the census, which was the Chinese census of 2010, the population then it was 21.81 million, which was including 8.75 million ethnic Han Chinese, which is 40% of the population. There was a huge increase since the occupation. So I would say that, you know, with that came a lot of discriminatory policies. For example, the bilingual education programs that were introduced slowly in the region as well in the late 80s. Beginning of 90s, I believe, which was an attempt for the government to really have all the Uyghurs to speak one language, which, I mean, bilingual education programs are portrayed or, officially as Uyghurs being given the opportunity to learn a second language. But in reality, if you look at the situation on the ground, it's really the erasure of Uyghur culture. And slowly over the years, the Chinese government has suppressed Uyghur as a medium of teaching in Uyghur schools. And also over the years, they have really reduced the schools that offer Uyghur education. For example, when I was growing up, I did my elementary school up until fifth grade in an all Uyghur language school. But now, you can't really find these schools. It's you only have Chinese schools, and the Uyghur kids have to learn, have to go through their education in Chinese language. So the opportunity for them to learn and to be educated in their mother tongue is kind of limited and restricted by the Chinese government, which is actually in violation of international law, but also domestic law. And over the time, there has been some, a few incidents in the region because no freedoms are guaranteed. You don't have all of the fundamental freedoms that are guaranteed in democratic countries, for example, freedom of expression, assembly, opinion, of press. None of these freedoms are present in the region, so which kind of led a group of people sometimes to lead some attacks on government officials or some parts of the region, and which another thing I guess the turning point is in 1993 there was the Huldja massacre, which the government repressed, there was a huge backlash against Uyghurs who were gathering to really practice cultural traditions and customs. And the Chinese authorities actually sent a troops of troops to Huldja, which is a southern which is a predominantly Uyghur part of Uyghur city. And there was a huge backlash and there was a lot of violence and a lot of Uyghurs disappeared and were killed during that massacre. And in 2009, when I was there for the first time, there was the Urumqi uprising, like I've mentioned before, which was in reaction to discriminatory policies, several years. But the incident that kind of sparked this was in a Shaodong factory in Eastern China, where Uyghur workers were killed in a factory because of rumors that were circulating in the factory that a couple of Uyghurs had raped Han Chinese females in the factory, which were just rumors that were spreading around. And the Chinese workers killed some of these Uyghur workers, and the government didn't do anything to address this situation. So thousands of people in Urumqi, Uyghur people, have started a peaceful protest in the streets of Urumqi on July 5th. And this protest was brutally cracked down by the Chinese government and authorities, and over the several upcoming days, there were tensions between Uyghurs and Chinese in the streets. And during that summer, a lot of Uyghur youth especially disappeared. And when I was there, I saw, a lot of the things that were happening, the horrible things. And this slowly started, the government started seeing the region as a threat to national security. And I would also say that one thing that contributed to the global situation right now, the global context, is the war on terror led by the US government after 9/11. So you can actually see that before 9/11 happened, the Chinese government never accused Uyghurs of being terrorists. They've always accused Uyghurs of being separatists or being backward people, but never, terrorism was never in the official narrative or language. But right after 9/11 and, the global war on terror led by the US, the Chinese government used that as a pretext and opportunity to really, I guess, control the region and gather support for that kind of repression that they were, doing against the Uyghur people. And so they saw that the global war terror justified these repressions, and they really jumped on the occasion. And ever since then, the bigger context or bigger pretext narrative from the Chinese regime has been a war on terrorism. And so if you look at, if you look at the camps that appeared in 2017, the official explanation for these camps is a fight against terrorism and to eliminate any kind of terrorist sentiment or extremism in the region. And this has been in the official discourse. So that has led to the genocide that we see today.
Thank you for the thoughtful answer. That was a lot. So thank you for that. But I do have another question as well. So obviously China doesn't allow journalists or humanitarian organizations to really investigate these camps. And we started hearing about these camps in about 2017. So what exactly is going on in these camps?
Yeah, it's a great question. So these camps were, we started hearing about these camps in 2017, more in the, I guess, mainstream media, but actually there were already some information that was out in late 2015, beginning 2016 about these camps. These camps, like I said, were really built for the Chinese government to re-educate people and really eliminate any kind of sentiment of you know, extremism or terrorism. But in reality, it's just to have a tighter grip in the region. And the Chinese government has introduced over the past few years, starting in 2015, a series of legislation to really, I would say, align their framework to be able to carry out these camps. So for example, they've introduced the counterterrorism law in 2016, which was widely condemned by the international community, especially the UN experts, who condemned this law because it was very vague. The Chinese government used a very vague and broad language to define terrorism. So acts such as wearing a veil for Uyghur women was considered an extremist or terrorist, behavior. And even for men to have long beards or just any kind of, you know, basic expression of religious identity was equated to terrorism. So the government started arbitrarily detaining millions of people. This is what we know today, is that we have at least 1.8 to 3 million of Uyghurs and other Turkic people in the region who are being detained in these camps. And the conditions are extremely harsh. We have several camp survivors who have fled the region, who were released because they had other national passports. And they have recounted the horrors of these camps, which, in each cell you have at least between 50 to 60 people who are crowded in these rooms, and the hygiene conditions are horrible. They don't shower daily, which leads to lice infections. They're maltreated. They don't, you know, the nutrition they have is extremely poor. They're given, you know, very basic food, and sometimes they're not given food as a way to be punished. They're tortured via several methods, for example, the use of tiger chairs during interrogations, psychological torture, physical torture, sexual abuse for women and men. Some of these former camp survivors have recounted their horrible stories of rape in these camps by officials, the guards who are surveying them. And there's just this constant fear and constant psychological and physical torture that really the detainees are not even allowed to speak between themselves, to speak their Uyghur language, to even, you know, express any kind of religious or ethnic identity inside, because otherwise they will be punished. And every day they have to pledge loyalty to the Chinese Communist Party by singing different songs. And on Fridays, they have to write reports thanking the Chinese Communist Party and thanking Xi Jinping for the lives that they are being offered and the re-education they are going through. So it's really, you know, a process of brainwashing and re-education, patriotic re-education, political re-education, in a way to really eliminate any kind of dissent, any kind of unique ethnic identity, and to really pledge loyalty, 100% loyalty to the Chinese Communist Party.
So would you compare this to like a modern day Holocaust, or is it more of a cultural genocide as opposed to an actual mass killing genocide?
Yes. So we have been very careful. Uyghur groups have been very careful to, you know, comparing it to the Holocaust, because I think that Holocaust was an atrocious time, a period in our history. And I don't think we can compare that to anything, but I think it does draw some parallels, and Jewish groups have actually been the ones drawing that parallel between the Holocaust and the genocide that we're seeing today. And I think it is, I think we should be careful to jump to these quick comparisons, but I think these two situations or horrors, they have their own, differences. And I think we can draw parallels, but I think it's fair to kind of take them apart and talk about them separately. And what we're seeing today, and we say it's a full-on genocide. Although in the past few years, there's been, allegations of cultural genocides, because of course there's like the cultural side, which is the Chinese government is trying to eliminate any kind of cultural manifestation of our identity. But also if you look at the recent, especially in the last year, we've gotten reports of all these, physical abuses and inside the camps, but also outside the camps. There's been, rapes, like I said, inside the camps, and there's been a lot of scrutiny and surveillance, heavy surveillance inside and outside of the camps. But especially, I think the most relevant report is on forced sterilization. And in the past few months, we have had major reports reporting on the government's scheme to forcibly reduce the birth rates in the region by forcibly sterilizing Uyghur women and forcing them to, for example, get abortions and birth control methods. And just this week, Adrian Zenz, who's been a prominent scholar who's been reporting on this based on CCP official documents and some other research documents from inside mainland China, he's seen that the overall objective of the Chinese Communist Party was to reduce the birth population in the region, to which they saw as a threat to national security. So with that, if you look at the genocide definition under the UN Convention, but also the Rome Statute, it is clearly, genocide is forcibly reducing the birth among a population group, ethnic group, is part of the definition of genocide. And there's also been, the separation of families, especially children who are being separated from their parents, who are sometimes sent to camps or just, who have disappeared, and the children are being taken away to state-run orphanages. So you have this transfer of population from, an ethnic group. There's also a transfer for the forced labor programs that the Chinese government has also started in the past few months or even years. So we're seeing actual manifestation of physical, what it appears to be a genocide.
Now, obviously, your roots are there. So do you have any family members who've been in these camps? And what have they told you if you have any personal connections?
So one thing to understand is that most Uyghurs starting in 2017 lost contact with their family members. Because another thing is that Uyghurs in the region can be sent to a camp, can be interned if they have connections with family members abroad. So just the fact that you have family or you have relatives abroad, that can be a reason for suspicion for the government, because they will often portray these people who have connections abroad as connections with terrorist organizations, or which is actually the official sentencing for the Chinese government. If you look at the sentencing for most people in the region, and especially the prominent like scholars and intellectuals, they've been sentenced with terrorism charges. And so especially if you have relatives in Muslim majority countries, that's a suspicious reason for the Chinese government, and you can be sent to region. So that's why since 2017, most Uyghurs living in the diaspora have completely lost connection with their family members, either because they have asked to stop contacting them, or out of fear of retaliation, we chose to cut ties with our relatives. So since 2017, I actually haven't been able to contact any of my relatives. I only have my immediate family back in Canada, but all my other relatives, aunts, cousins, friends, and other family relatives, they were all back home, and I haven't been able to communicate with them. So I don't know what happened to them, but I know from various sources that I have at least over 50 family relatives who have been missing, and they might be interned in camps, but I have no idea. And there's no way for me to really know, really.
Right. That's terrible. So what is that? I mean, given this information, what's being done? Where's the outrage? Is there any help from the United States? Any UN resolution? Has the UN intervened? Well, is there any end in sight here?
So I think it's fair to say that in the last 2 years specifically, the international condemnation has been, has been present, and there has been a wide condemnation for these atrocities, but there are very limited actions that have been taken by different governments, including, the US and the UN specifically. I think it's important to recognize that in 2018, I think why the crisis is widely known today is because of 2019, there was two important events happening at the UN. The first one was the Universal Periodical Review on China, which happens every 4 years. And this was a very important time for the committee to really sit down and assess all the evidence that they had received from different civil society organizations working on China. And at the same time, there was the CERD review, which was the committee against the elimination of, on the elimination of racial discrimination on China. They also reviewed China's, policies, and they, at the end of the review, they came out saying that, acknowledging the existence of these camps, and they said that there were over 1 million of Uyghurs detaining these camps arbitrarily, which was then picked up by international media and international community. Because one thing is for sure is that any kind of official communication coming from the UN is extremely valuable, because it's very reputable and credible. So that was kind of used by the international community. And that's why there was a focus on the Uyghur, the situation. Because before that, very few countries, very few people knew about the Uyghurs. And after that happened, it was picked up by everyone. And I would say in the last year, there has been a wide coverage on the issue because of the reporting that's been increasing on issues like forced labor, forced sterilization, and so on. So governments have been very slow, but at least there's been now international outrage. A few parliaments around the world have voted on the genocide resolution, including Canada, the Dutch Parliament, the UK, Lithuanian Parliament, and there are some the similar kind of debates going on in Germany, Italy, Belgium, and some other governments. And the US government has actually under Trump has recognized it officially as genocide, and the new administration as well recognized it 2 months ago in their annual report, labeling the crisis as genocide. What we hoped is that more countries can recognize this crisis as genocide and really act on this. Some concrete actions that have been taken, by various governments have been on forced labor issues. So, for example, in the US, the Customs and Border Protection has issued import bans from specifically on cotton related products from the Xinjiang region and on tomato products as well. So there has been similar regulations adopted by the Canadian and UK governments. There has been legislations that have been introduced in several governments as well, specifically the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act that's being discussed in the US at the moment. And we're working as well in the European at the European level to on pieces of legislation. For example, in the EU, one thing that's been really important is the due diligence, mandatory due diligence law. So I think there has been a lot of concrete actions taken on forced labor products, forced labor issues, because we understood that it is tainting our global supply chain. That is why it's actually, the problem is bigger than just China. It's really tainting our global supply chains, and consumers around the world are actually buying or using products made of forced labor. So I think this is why it has become a priority. And actually, this is going to be one of the key issues being discussed at the G7 summit this week. So we really hope that, you know, there will be more actions taken. And actually, since starting Friday until this Monday, there was the Uyghur Tribunal happening, which is a people's tribunal that was led by Sir Geoffrey Nice. And over the course of 4 days, we heard from over 30 witnesses, including fact witnesses and expert witnesses on the different genocidal policies carried out by the government. And we're hoping to see, urgent action taken by governments around the world.
So how effective are these actions? Because obviously the situation is ongoing. Does not seem to be ending anytime soon. So in your opinion, how effective are these resolutions?
I think the resolutions on genocide is, I think, first of all, very important for the Uyghur community as a whole, because we really haven't been given the opportunity of exploring the traditional paths of justice, because those paths are blocked because China hasn't ratified some treaties, or they just blocked because of their seat at the Security Council at the UN. So for us to be able to bring China in front of the international justice system is very difficult. So by recognizing this as genocide, what we're hoping to achieve is that countries can take concrete actions such as economic bans, economic sanctions, which is actually very, very impactful, because it hurts China the most. As we've seen with the forced labor, the bans that has been taking place in the US or in other countries, China has reacted to these by, encouraging the Chinese consumer base to boycott foreign companies and their products in China, which led to this huge scandal in China. I think it was in April when they started boycotting products from Nike or Adidas or even H&M. And so the Chinese government is reacting to these sanctions that are being introduced. And another thing is sanctioning officials who are actually the engineers of that genocide. For example, Chen Chuanguo, who is the party secretary of the region. So we're really pushing for these concrete measures to be taken. And also another thing to remember is that the Uyghurs in the diaspora are also experiencing the consequences of that genocide, because it's not only Uyghurs inside the region who are direct victims, but also Uyghurs in the diaspora, because we're constantly harassed, intimidated by the Chinese government via their embassies abroad. They're trying to silence us by using hostage diplomacy with our relatives, or even, the fate of Uyghur refugees and asylum seekers who are, living in very precarious situations where they're in fear of deportation back to China in different countries. So countries and governments around the world can have direct impacts, can make a difference on all of these issues. And this is what we hope to achieve, to really push also for countries to pressure China to allow open investigation, open and independent, unfettered access to the region, so that UN experts or other independent experts can really see what's happening.
So I do have two more questions. And the first one that I do want to ask is what does it mean for you to be a Uyghur, especially now?
For me, I think being Uyghur today is being strong. I think it's kind of embodying. I feel like being Uyghur today is, whether you like it or not, you're an activist. Just by saying you're Uyghur, you become automatically an activist, because we're all so impacted by what's happening at home. We're you know, even the Uyghurs who have who were born and raised in different countries outside of the region, they're impacted because their relatives, our relatives, are, you know, missing or detained, and we're not able to go back home. So our identity is attacked, is being erased back home, but also you know, in different countries, and even in democratic countries like Germany or in the US or Australia, because we're constantly surveilled, monitored, and the Chinese government has also launched, you know, in the recent years, aggressive campaigns of misinformation campaigns, propaganda campaigns, trying to really target our ethnic identity and trying to dehumanize us. So for us, being Uyghur is to challenge that narrative. So by challenging that, you become an activist. And being an activist is extremely tiring because you constantly have something to say, constantly have something to prove, and constantly something to counter. So, and by becoming, you know, an activist, and just by being Uyghur, you're a target for the government. And being a target of an authoritarian regime is very difficult on a daily basis. Not only do you have to deal with the psychological trauma of losing your relatives or, you know, having relatives detained, but you also have to deal with being a target for the government. So I think it's very difficult. It's a very difficult position and identity to you know, carry that identity with you. But I think it's also fulfilling because we are a community, such a resilient community, and we, in times, you know, in such hard times, we become one, we become our ties are stronger and nothing can break us apart. And I feel like this genocide has only brought us together even closer. Even, you know, if you don't even know Uyghurs living in other countries, you are connected because of the situation. So I feel like no matter what the Chinese government is saying about us or doing to us, we're not going to nothing is going to break us apart.
Right. So like hard times definitely bring people closer together, makes you a little more prideful, definitely. So my last question for you. So as a Jewish person, I'm very, very sensitive to issues like these. Obviously we have a slogan called Never Again. That just doesn't go for Jewish people, that goes for everyone else. But obviously, you know, it's hard to stand up to an authoritarian government. You know, not much can be done. It's definitely a difficult situation. So how could the average person help? How could people in the West contribute to the Uyghur cause? How could they help them out? Is posting an infographic on Instagram enough, or what else could be done?
I think the infographics are very useful, especially in our day and age of activism. I feel like we learn a lot about these infographics because they kind of break down all the, you know, like concrete steps that can be taken by the general population or just any citizen. I think, you know, the first thing to do is to educate yourself on the situation, on the issue. Get in touch with Uyghur organizations. I think there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there, especially sponsored by the government. So be careful, you know, about the materials that you consume. So that I would suggest you to follow Uyghur organizations like us. You can follow us at Uyghur Congress on all the social media outlets. And also other there are many good organizations working specifically on this cause. So educate yourself. That's the first thing. Second thing is boycott the brands who are linked to forced labor. That's something that you can do quite easily. And boycott campaigns have been actually proven efficient in many different causes. So I think that's one place to start with, because as a consumer, you have a voice, you have a power, and you can say no to these entities and businesses who are profiting from human rights violations. You can write to these businesses and their CEOs. You can write to them. We have different campaigns going on where you have like ready-made templates, emails, or petitions that you can sign. You can support our campaign to boycott the Beijing Olympics, which we are working on. We've been working on in the past few months. We have actually a global day of action taking place on June 23rd all around the world. So follow us on social media to stay updated on the actions near your city or near you. Another thing would be to write to your elected officials wherever you might be. It's quite easy to do. You can just find them online to, you know, given like where you live, and write them and ask them to support different initiatives. For example, in the US, you can ask your representatives to support the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, which we're still looking for sponsors. And it is a bipartisan, effort. So urge all your senators to or representatives to support that. You can also donate your time by volunteering to different organizations or money to support, organizations who are working at the front line, supporting the Uyghur people in different ways. Just share about the issue, talk about this issue, have conversation with your, relatives or your surroundings, and try to really spread awareness on the issue. I think it really does make a difference.
Absolutely. And it's very important to obviously spread awareness for this issue. I don't feel like it's talked nearly as much for how absolutely, I guess, for lack of a better term, heinous it is. So it's definitely good to get the word out. But yeah, Zumertai, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And thank you for getting the word out.
Thank you so much, Jeremy, for having me.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you.